from this study, we have learned that the microbiome kind of profile cannot be fully restored by adenoma removal. So continued prevention efforts through lifestyle modification is important to kind of help mitigate the risk of subsequent cancer.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. We're a nonprofit scientific organization advancing science in probiotics, prebiotics, and related fields. This episode is part of our series exploring gut microbiota and colorectal cancer. We'll be speaking with experts about how microbes in the human gut contribute to colorectal cancer development and how this research is driving advances in diagnosis and treatment.
Hello, I'm Daniel Tancredi, and today I'm delighted to be able to speak to Professor Mingyong Song, who's Associate Professor of Clinical Epidemiology and Nutrition, the Faculty Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of Epidemiology at Harvard, and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. We're going to be talking about an extraordinary study that he's just published with colleagues, taking advantage of the Nurses' Health Study and the MicroN project to help us gain a better understanding of the relationship of the gut microbiome to colorectal cancer, whether it's a cause or a consequence. So, Mingyong, we're very delighted to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us a little bit of an overview of the epidemiological evidence regarding whether or not microbiome alterations are cause versus consequence of colorectal cancer, and then we'll dive into this extraordinary study you just did.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So right now, from the epidemiologic perspective, all the published studies are retrospective. In other words, the samples were collected from individuals who already have established the cancer. And we know that microbiome lives in the gut, and cancer, colon cancer, also arises in the gut. So that creates a really kind of complicated question, as you just said, whether the changes in the microbiome that we observed associated with colon cancer represent the cause or consequence of the cancer development, because there has been evidence, we have known that the cancer itself can induce substantial changes in the local gut environment, and that can confer selective pressure or confer competitive advantage on the microbiome that can lead to further changes in the microbiome. So that's kind of the overarching question we want to address. Can we better understand the cause versus consequence question by leveraging the longitudinal microbiome samples?
Nice way to describe that is, what are the drivers and what are the passengers? And some of the passengers are drivers also.
Exactly. Yes. The driver passenger model comes from the genomic field, but it can also be well applied to to kind of describing the microbiome cancer relationship here. Yeah.
And there's two features about colorectal cancer that are notable in the context of study design. There's an adenoma carcinoma pathway, and that could take 20 years or so between the development of benign polyps and cancer. And so this is why screening and resecting those polyps is so important. But it also gives an opportunity for taking advantage of national treasure data sets like the Nurses' Health Study 2, which was initiated in 1989. And then a team at Harvard that Dr. Song is a part of created a sub-study, the microbiome among nurses. So can you talk to us about how you were able to take advantage of these two data sources to set up your cell-hosted micro paper this past summer?
Yeah, thank you. So as you just said, the natural history of colon cancer has been very well understood. And the majority of the sporadic colon cancer arises from adenoma, which is a primary precursor lesion for colon cancer. And we have also known that removing adenoma can reduce colon cancer risk. That's how colonoscopy screening becomes kind of one of the major prevention modalities for colon cancer. However, we also know that among individuals with adenoma removal, they remain at a risk of colon cancer. And among individuals removed with high-risk adenomas, they even had a higher risk of developing colon cancer compared to adenoma-free individuals. So they are still considered as a high-risk group. So that's why there is the colonoscopy surveillance that is also routinely recommended in the clinic to kind of help further mitigate the risk after initial screening.
So we have this large data set, over 100,000 nurses that we're studying. And then for a subset of them, you've collected microbiome, in some cases, many years after we started following up the nurses. What did you do to take advantage of these two sources of data to gain some insights into what the microbiome might look like and the metabolome might look like after adenoma removal, and whether or not that's meaningful in terms of comparisons to control patients who didn't have an adenoma removed, as well as to comparisons to external controls from patients who actually developed colorectal cancer?
Yes. So the microbiome among nurses study is a sub-study within the Nurses Health Study 2, which was established in 1989. So over the past few decades, we have collected very detailed epidemiologic data every 2 to 4 years. And in late 2019, we initiated the microbiome among nurses study by collecting stool and oral microbiome samples from women who remained under active follow-up in the Nurses Health Study 2 cohort. And so far, we have collected samples from about 20,000 participants. And within this microN project, we thought some of the participants already developed adenoma, already had colonoscopy screening, had a positive finding from the colonoscopy, and we have the very detailed histopathological information on these adenomas from these patients. So we thought, this is actually a nice kind of population for us to study whether the adenoma removal can completely restore the microbiome. So that's why we conducted a metagenomic sequencing on the stool samples from participants who had a history of adenoma removal, and then matched them with individuals with no adenoma at the time of the stool collection, and to see whether we can still identify the microbiome differences between the adenoma group and the control group. So here, the adenoma group would be the historical adenoma, right? Their adenoma has already been removed. Yeah.
And it's interesting because, you know, this is like one of these high risk, high reward. You could really see, well, it's been, you know, many years after the removal of the adenoma.
On average, it's 12 years. Yeah.
Yes. And some of them as many as 29 years, I think, and some were like 4 years. But it's one of those things where in the studies where, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of times we get the stool samples pretty much close in time to when the resection happens. But in your case, and we know from those studies that we still see that there's effects, like there's some differences compared to healthy controls. But, you know, we have many years separating the removal of the adenoma and the interrogation of the microbiome. So you also brought in another set of studies on the colorectal cancer patients. Can you just tell our listeners about that real quick?
Yes, the colon cancer data set is from the published studies of metagenomics. So we want to see whether the microbiome profiles we identified among the historical adenoma patients is similar to those observed in the colon cancer patients. So we just assembled the metagenomic data from the published case control studies of colon cancer for comparison.
And I thought that was particularly interesting. So you correlated What were the differences we saw compared the adenoma versus the controls in terms of like the effect sizes? And you then compare them to the colorectal cancer effects. And in many cases, there was the same organisms were either enriched or depleted. And then there were times where there were notable discrepancies. The interesting thing about the discrepancies, I have to editorialize Professor Song, is I think they actually play into the overall hypothesis. Like when they are both enriched, like in other words, when there's more of a species in both the adenoma and in the cancer, that goes with the idea that that species might become more and more enriched as the process develops. But yes. It could also go the other way around for things that are more passengers, like the inflammophilic oral microbiota that are associated with colorectal cancer. They're not necessarily going to be there when you remove the adenoma. They might come along later on to take advantage of the site. So your workflow, I thought, was just remarkable. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about the what's basically figure two in your paper, you know, showing when there were so many times when the same species was enriched in both adenoma and in carcinoma, and then other times it wasn't.
Yes. So what we found, like just as what you just said, we did see a correlation between the changes in the microbiome for associated with historical adenomas and the microbiome changes observed in colon cancer. So the correlation is about 0.3. It's modest, but it's also quite substantial. We know that for microbiome studies, there's a lot of variation, a lot of heterogeneity. So having observed this correlation of 0.3 is already quite substantial. And also, we did see some very consistent changes in some of the microbiome features associated with both historical adenoma and colon cancer. And also, I would agree with your interpretation that some of these features are likely represent the passenger bacteria. In other words, the bacteria just kind of grow or become more advantageous because of the local environmental changes in the gut. So they would just continue to be present in the gut along the development of the colon cancer from the adenoma phase to the invasive cancer phase.
And another thing, and it begins with that earlier, that part of the analysis, although you're still early in your career, you've already made a major impact on our society's understanding of the real importance of lifestyle modifications. So can you talk to us about how you took advantage of the data, the rich data in the Nurses Health Study to correlate the behaviors we know we should all do in terms of diet and exercise and how that's associated with either good or bad microbiome and metabolites?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was trained in nutrition for my PhD and have been studying the role of diet and lifestyle in colon cancer development. And colon cancer is probably the cancers that is most strongly associated with diet and the lifestyle. And we have shown that over roughly half of the newly diagnosed cancer cases can be potentially prevented by diet and lifestyle modifications. So colon cancer is very strongly associated with diet and lifestyle. And we also know that diet and lifestyle is really important for shaping the microbiome, right? The long-term kind of lifestyle habits are basically the major driver of the between-person differences in the microbiome. And that's why we leveraged our epidemiologic data from the Nurses Health Study 2 cohort to further look at whether the microbiome changes we observed in the adenoma can be explained by the diet and the lifestyle variation. Yeah.
And I know that our audience is a lot of very well-informed scientists, but let's review what some of those key lifestyle factors are. What would you advise your your patients and family and friends, Dr. Song, about the really important things to be mindful of from a lifestyle perspective in terms of protection against colorectal cancer.
Yes, like obesity, smoking, alcohol consumption, red, and particularly processed red meat have been all convincingly associated with higher risk of colon cancer, whereas fiber, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and also calcium have been associated with lower risk of colon cancer. And these dietary lifestyle factors have been consistently implicated in the continuum of colon cancer development from the adenoma derived to the invasive cancer phase.
Yes. And I thought it was interesting, too, how you observed how the correlations with lifestyle factors tended to be more strong in the subpopulation of the adenoma patients compared to the control patients. And the stories that were told, like your very savvy interrogation of the metabolome kind of showed what we'd expect, the disrupted fecal fatty acid metabolism. And, you know, kind of underscoring the importance of, you know, fiber-rich diet and kind of really maintaining a good diet to feed our gut. I know you're involved in clinical translation. What would you kind of see as the best case in terms of our being able to take advantage of this research and other ongoing research to inform efforts for screening and for prevention and for treatment?
Yes, there are a couple of important implications from this study. The first is, like we just discussed, we observed a very consistent association in the changes of the microbiome and the diet lifestyle. So the healthy diet lifestyle tends to be associated with the good bacteria, the bacteria that got depleted in adenoma or even in colon cancer patients. And the unhealthy diet lifestyle tends to be associated with unhealthy bugs, the bugs that are enriched in adenoma and colon cancer. So that really speaks to the importance of maintaining a healthy diet and lifestyle even after adenoma removal for prevention of colon cancer. Right? Like from this study, we have learned that the microbiome kind of profile cannot be fully restored by adenoma removal. So continued prevention efforts through lifestyle modification is important to kind of help mitigate the risk of subsequent cancer.
Yes, and let's be clear too to our audience. We really want you to come in and get screened because doing the screening and the follow-up is super important. It's just what we also would want you to be aware of is having those benign polyps be removed doesn't mean that you're back to a risk-free state. You still have to be mindful.
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's the message we would like the public to be aware of. And from the research perspective, I think the findings open new avenues for further research. One, it goes back to our initial big picture question regarding the microbiome is a cause or consequence of colon cancer development, right? So this study just kind of tried to address part of this puzzle. I think what is missing is the very early phase of the microbiome, of the colon cancer development. Can we identify the microbiome changes among healthy individuals that some of them will develop adenoma or even colon cancer later on? So in other words, we need the prospective studies where the stool samples will be collected before lesion development. So that's something we are currently working on, by assembling another case control study of incident polyp. So by incident polyp, we mean the polyps were diagnosed after stool collection so that we can compare the microbiome changes associated with incident polyp versus those associated with prevalent historical polyp and versus those associated with colon cancer to really map out the microbiome changes along the continuum of the colon cancer development.
Yes. Yeah, we'll need to do these prospective studies, but also take advantage of the existing data, the data source we have. I I really appreciate that the team at Harvard has the MicroN study, being able to take advantage of this amazing nurses, the nurses' health studies and the health professional studies there. Let's dive in just real briefly into another topic that's a mutual interest to both of us, personalized screening. And so you've championed colorectal cancer screening going, you know, before age 50, and, you know, early onset colorectal cancer is really emerging, is really a frightening thing how much it's increased. Can you talk to us about the role of how us being able to use information perhaps on the microbiome or on metabolites to target personalized screening, or should we just get everybody in as early as possible? Like, what are your thoughts on that? I know you have a lot to say, but just maybe some highlights.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge topic, and there's a lot of like controversies, right? Like there, we can argue both ways, right? Like getting everyone screened would be kind of great to really minimize the colon cancer risk at the population level. But on the other hand, the resources, the potential adverse effect associated with screening also makes us wonder whether a more tailored approach would be more beneficial from the resource allocation and the population prevention perspective. So for me, like, I feel like, as you mentioned, for early onset colon cancer, because the absolute risk is still substantially lower compared to that among older adults, and we know that colonoscopy is invasive, is very expensive, is complicated, and it's not fun to do, right? Yeah. So I think it kind of like, within that space, I do think that more precision approach, like a risk-based approach, can be really helpful to really identify individuals who are at a particular high risk of developing colon cancer, and to tailor even the starting age of screening, right? Like the current recommendation is to start screening at 45. At age of 45, but we know that some individuals develop colon cancer before that age. Yes. So there's definitely still variation within the younger age range. So the risk-based approach can be really helpful to identify those high-risk individuals and to start screening early.
And do you see the value for like the fecal-based tests that aren't as burdensome on the patient as the colonoscopies? Like the fecal immunohistochemical assays and things like that for the younger patients?
Yeah, I from my perspective, from my experience, like the stool collection and the self-stool collection, it's very convenient, it's very hygiene, like it's really easy to do. So I don't see it become a huge like a burden on the participant side. I think what we need to address is the accuracy, right? Like to really quantify and also maximize the accuracy of any stool test that we may develop in the future, like a microbiome-based test. And from the early studies, we have known that the microbiome has microbiome-based signatures have very high accuracy for identifying colon cancer patients versus controls. Yes. But whether we can develop a similar signature for precursors for adenomas, that's a different question. Like from so far, from the data that we have seen, the accuracy tends to be pretty low. We need further studies to identify the more predictive features to really enhance the accuracy to really make that a translation.
Yes. And even though we started the podcast talking about the passengers and the drivers, you know, the causes and the consequence, I would just quickly note that for screening purposes, if we see that, if we are able to find a signature associated with the presence of cancer, it wouldn't matter if it is a passenger or a driver. It still would be helpful for helping us find patients that need to be treated. So,
exactly. Yeah. It's Dr. just that if we want to identify the early stage lesions, we would want to identify as many driver,
yes,
passenger, driver bacteria as possible. Right?
Exactly. And also to guide intervention efforts and targeted interventions, and understand more about the etiology for sure.
Yeah.
Dr. Exactly. Song, your work is super exciting. How can our listeners follow your future work?
Oh, thank you. I think like we will continue to publish our studies as early as it becomes available. And I would ask your audience to stay tuned for our ongoing study in this field, particularly regarding the driver-passenger microbiome for colon cancer. So,
we wish you every success. You've had an extraordinary career and you're just getting started. So,
thank you so much. I really appreciated that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.